Welcome to Food for Thought. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/vegetarian for your free audiobook download. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm an author and educator dedicated to empowering people to make informed food choices, to debunking myths about veganism, to being a voice for animals, and to giving people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and you can learn more by visiting my website, compassionatecook.com. Also, I'm the author and creator of the 30-Day Vegan Challenge online program. It's alive and thriving, and you can help me spread the word by sharing it with your networks, on your blogs, on your Facebook page, on your Twitter feed, etc. If you go to 30dayveganchallenge.com, you can start the program, you can check out the teaser video, you can buy it as a gift, and you can also scroll down to the bottom of the page and you'll see a link called Banners and Media, where you'll find a number of different sized graphics. I'd be so grateful if you would let people know that this is really the ultimate, most comprehensive guide out there for helping people to transition to living healthfully and compassionately. Also, you can sign up anytime you like. That's one of the things that distinguishes this program from others. And yes, if you're already vegan, you will get something out of it. You'll get a lot out of it, in fact. I'm so thrilled by the community forming in the discussion area of the password protected portal once you sign up, once you're in the middle of the challenge. And I encourage everyone to join, if not just for that. Newbies need help from experienced vegans, and you can share tips and camaraderie and resources. So 30dayveganchallenge.com, everything you need to make this transition and to do it confidently, joyfully, and healthfully. Before I get started with today's episode, first and foremost, I'd like to thank my amazing platinum members. I don't have any gold members to thank, but I do have my platinum members to thank. James Killen of Incentive Personal Training in Australia. That's www.personal-training.com.au. There's Anonymous in Norway. You know who you are. Grace Rodriguez, Tim Anderson, David Cabrera, and Alexander Gray, and also Alexander Gray Associates. Please check out alexandergray.com. And Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City. That's peacefoodcafe.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Audible. And as I said, you can get a free audio download if you go to audiblepodcast.com/vegetarian. Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, to your smartphone, to your MP3 player. After listening to today's podcast episode and hearing all the literary references I make, I highly recommend you shoot over to audiblepodcast.com/vegetarian and choose your free download. Once you listen, you'll see why it's relevant that I recommend you choose Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte or The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson or the poetry of Wordsworth. Whatever you choose, you can try the free trial at audiblepodcast.com/vegetarian. And just note, this offer is available in the U.S. and Canada. So check it out. Browse titles of other books we've discussed as well in the podcast low these many years. You can type in vegan to see all the books on this topic and animals or animal rights. And I think you'll really enjoy it. So audiblepodcast.com/vegetarian. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by becoming a Compassionate Cooks Club member. Go to compassionatecook.com, click on sign up in the right-hand corner, or become a member in the left-hand column, and you'll see all the gifts listed on the join page. And just to let you know, one of the gifts is about to become very special just for members. I've stopped selling signed copies of my books through my website. I've stopped selling any copies of my books through my website to the general public, but members and supporters will always have this option. And your copies will not only be signed, but they'll be personalized. So anytime a member purchases any of my books, and don't forget, members also get a discount on these books, they will be personalized and signed. So thank you to all of the members and all of the supporters and all of the subscribers and all of you listeners and everyone out there with an open heart. Now, let us begin our journey to the United Kingdom, shall we? The last time I was in England was in 2003. And I've been very anxious to go back since. I've promised David, however, that our next vacation will not be anywhere near the British Isles because we've done quite a few trips there in the last few years. I'm an unabashed Anglophile, I admit it, and I was looking forward to visiting not only Scotland, but parts of England that we hadn't been to before, particularly areas where my literary heroes once lived and wrote. So the itinerary we planned involved flying into London and taking the train right up to York, then renting a car from there and exploring the Yorkshire County, for a couple days, and then heading up to the Lake District, and then heading up to Edinburgh, and that's precisely what we did. Our journey began on the plane, obviously, and we were very lucky to have been able to fly first class to London because of the amount of travel we do. We had racked up enough miles to redeem them for a first class journey on the way there, but not on the way back, which became a nightmare flight on the way home because our flight was canceled, which was lovely, but I will leave that out. For many years, I've been traveling United. We'll see if that continues because the last few times I have flown with them, I've had some trouble. But nonetheless, we had our miles. We were able to fly first class. And of course, before I left, we made sure that our meals were vegan on the plane. We are in the system as getting vegan meals whenever they're available, but it doesn't always pan out. So United definitely serves meals in first class, in domestic and international first class, and it serves meals in economy on international flights, but not on domestic flights. Of course, you have to pay for those little boxes, those little snack boxes. Amazingly, they got our meals right, and we had vegan food, though uninspired food, but vegan food. I mean, it was decent vegan food, decent enough for a plane ride. I didn't have very high expectations. However, I didn't take any chances, and I had already made a few tofurkey sandwiches that morning. Those who've watched my travel video in the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, I talk all about the different things to bring on a plane and not get stopped by security. I often make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That's a really good go-to travel option because it's not messy, when you open up the sandwich on the plane. But I thought I'd change it up. And so tofurkey sandwiches are a really good option as well. I'd cut up some carrots and some celery. And because I knew, because of past experience, that a typical hummus container from the store is too large to pass security and strangely and stupidly is considered a liquid, I transferred the hummus that I had bought to two smaller containers, and I had no problem getting through. I also had some nuts with us and some trail mix and some energy bars. So we were definitely not going to starve on the way to London. I'm sure I don't have to tell you, I brought my tea thermos, the same one I had and lost and then recovered with me in Ireland, and the same one that I heartily recommend. So you can find it in my store at compassionatecook.com under shop, under Colleen's Amazon store. And you'll see I think it's in the featured favorites section, and it's on that first page. So I had my tea, I had my water bottle, some food, some books, a pad, a pen, and my husband, and I was wanting for nothing. Except my cats, perhaps, I guess, but they didn't come with us. So we arrived in London and immediately hopped on the tube to King's Cross so we could take the train to York, which was our first destination. We found our hotel, we unloaded our bags, we walked around a bit, and then we had lunch at Goji Vegetarian Restaurant on one of the precious streets in York. It's an adorable little restaurant serving simple vegetarian fare with lots of vegan options. Actually, my burger was very, very good. It was a mushroom burger. And it's interesting, when I asked for it without dairy cheese, they happily offered smoked tofu instead, which is interesting. And I remember this from Ireland. It seems that if you are in a vegetarian restaurant and you ask for the vegan version of a sandwich or burger whereby they remove the cheese, they add tofu instead, but not a soft tofu that's meant to have the consistency of a creamy cheese. It was literally a slice of firm tofu on top of the grilled portobello mushroom. It was delicious. It was flavored really nicely. And the whole burger was delicious. But it's just very interesting because that's not done here. It's just not done in the United States. And it was topped with a vegan aioli. So it did have a nice creamy sauce with it and lettuce and pickles. And it was yummy. David had the hummus plate and the roasted vegetable soup, both of which were vegan by default and very delicious. We didn't have any of the dessert, but 4 out of 5 of the desserts were vegan. So it was a lovely lunch. As fatigued as we were, I do recommend you go to gojicafe.co.uk for more information. And they also have a takeaway counter, which I'll get to. Well, I can tell you now, they have a takeaway counter, and we did use it again for the rest of our trip. So Goji Vegetarian Cafe, and York is just just so lovely. I want to go back. We spent the day getting to know York, and our hotel was literally steps away from York Minster, which is an absolutely incredible Gothic cathedral that had several lives because it was destroyed by fire many times, but it's absolutely breathtaking. It's apparently the largest of its kind in the world, and you can see more of it with photos by going to yorkminster.org. But obviously, if you're in York, you can't miss York Minster. You have to go. And we were steps away from it. It was pretty lovely. The first night, we went to a local pub to meet a group for a nighttime walking tour of the city, and it was a great little pub on River Ouse called King's Arms. And so the actor host of this tour told a number of ghost stories about buildings and areas around town, though he never told any about the shambles, not this particular tour, not this particular guide. Certainly there are horror stories to tell about the shambles. Now, you've heard of the shambles if you've ever used that word. Of course, if you've ever said that something is in a shambles, you're saying that it's in complete disarray. A shambles is a place or scene of bloodshed and carnage, because the original meaning refers to a butcher's slaughterhouse. Even more precisely, it comes from the Middle English word shamel, S-H-A-M-E-L, or shamel house, a place where meat animals are butchered and sold, and where meat is sold. Coming from the Old English word for table, which comes from Latin scabulum or scamalum, which means bench or stool. Now, that seems innocent enough, but by the Middle Ages, that word scabulum or scamalum referred literally to the table or low bench on which butchers displayed their cuts of animal flesh. The Shambles is a little street in York called such because it was the street on which there were many butcher shops. That's where the butcher shops were. It's the oldest street in York. It was mentioned in the Doomsday Book of William the Conqueror, a book that was published in 1086. So this street is over 900 years old, and I hate to think of how many animals were butchered in those many years. Many of the buildings on the street today date back to the late 14th and 15th century, around 1350 to 1475. In the 1870s, there were 25 butcher shops on that street. And today, thank goodness, there are none on that street. There is a butcher shop kind of behind it, but not on that street. And other market towns in other cities also have areas called the Shambles. And the one in York is now a tourist area. Now, admittedly, all the buildings and streets in York are very charming and very picturesque. And I can't deny there's a certain medieval charm to this street. However, it really felt very heavy and very sad to me. Maybe I only felt that because I knew what it once was, but David agreed, it just had this very sinister atmosphere to it. How can it not? The pavements are raised on either side of the cobbled street to form a channel where the butchers would wash away the animals' innards and blood twice a week. The buildings on either side of the street are angled toward one another in order to block out the sun. So when this was a butcher street, the meat wouldn't roast in the sun, and so you can still see the hooks the animals would have been hung on. Just describing it reminds me of a horror movie. This is just a horror movie when we talk about slaughtered animals. Of course, in the Middle Ages, when it was dominated by butcher shops, there were no sanitation laws and no hygiene facilities, so the blood and the guts and any body parts cut off of animals and not used were just thrown into the middle of the street where the butchering was carried out. Hence, any scene of total disorder and mess is now referred to as a shambles. So I could make up a few horror stories, I'm sure, about what the animals endured and the number of animals who were killed and the scenes that occurred in the York Shambles, but I'll leave it up to your imagination. I think that's probably good enough. Moving on, we stayed at the Guy Fawkes Inn. I said this was just literally right across the street from York Minster. It's an old inn built on the site where Guy Fawkes was born in 1570. Of course, his story ended 35 years later when he was arrested and hanged for trying to blow up Parliament on November 5th, 1605. I'm sure you know that story. Hopefully, if you don't, go read your history books. It was a lovely inn in a fantastic location with a great pub that was packed every night and literally steps away from York Minster, which is where Guy Fawkes was baptized, in fact. Our windows looked out onto York Minster. So ask for, if you do go to the Guy Fawkes Inn, ask for rooms that are in the front. And yeah, there are bells, the cathedral rings, and there are other churches around the city that rings bells, but they never hindered us. They never woke us up or anything. It's worth being that close. The breakfast, however, was a little uninspired, but they did the job. They had already gotten some soy milk for us, and they had a range of cereals plus toast and jams and fruit. The hot breakfast, not surprisingly, were all dominated by animal meat dishes, but they made some beans and mushrooms and tomatoes in oil for us, as opposed to using butter, which they had used for the other guests. So it was nothing amazing, but it happily sustained us until lunchtime. So it was fine. And they were really happy to make sure we had everything we needed to have a vegan breakfast. So that's how our remaining days in York began: breakfast at the Guy Fawkes Inn, walking around York, and visiting many historic spots, including the Monk Bar, one of the four medieval gatehouses in York. This one was built in the early 14th century, intended to be a fort, which still has a working portcullis, which is pretty amazing. Richard III, if you don't know it, has always been my favorite Shakespeare character. My undergraduate thesis was on Richard III, so it was kind of exciting to be in York for because Richard III was pretty prominent there. He was the Duke of York. You probably remember the War of the Roses. Anyway, so he built the topmost chamber in this in the Monk Bar in 1484, and the gatehouse is now a Richard III museum. Unfortunately, the museum itself was really cheesy, just done on the cheap. But nonetheless, it was pretty awesome to be on this spot, and it's also a great starting point to walk what's called the Roman Wall, which surrounds the city. So after we walked on the wall a bit, we hopped in the car, headed to Fountains Abbey, which was incredible if you've never been there. And I really recommend the short drive to see the remains of what was once a thriving abbey throughout many centuries. We returned to York. I'm trying to spare you anything that might not be interesting to you, but we returned to York and walked around this beautiful city some more. And then we enjoyed a delicious dinner at Ambiente, which is a very vegan-friendly restaurant that specializes in Spanish cuisine and tapas. In fact, they're so vegan-friendly that even though they broadcast their vegetarian options all over their regular menu, they even have a specially marked version of their menu to indicate what is vegan or veganizable. They even list which of their wines are vegan. So we had the vegetarian tapas platter for two. What's really nice is that you can even switch out different dishes from that, you know, kind of contained section, the vegetarian tapas platter for two. You can even switch out other dishes so you don't have to stick with what's listed on that platter. So we had the pan catalan, which is a toasted bread with tomato and garlic. We had mushrooms with caramelized shallots and tarragon cream. We had green beans pan fried in garlic with sun-dried tomatoes and pine nuts. We had a vegetable tagine with squash, sultanas, and rice. And we had patatas bravas, which are crispy potatoes with a spicy tomato sauce. And there's also a vegan paella. There's lots more. You can actually just go to their website, check out their menu, and they even have the vegetarian menu there. But you can see on the menu all of the things that are marked V. So that's ambiente-tapas.co.uk. So ambiente, A-M-B-I-E-N-T-E. -tapas.co.uk. And I'm going to have this on my website, certainly on the page for this podcast episode. I'll definitely have links to these restaurants that I'm naming. So dessert was fantastic also. Knowing by now that we were vegan, they said they could bring us their churros, which is basically fried dough. Churros are fried dough. They're like donuts. They're just fried dough rolled in cinnamon and sugar. And they're often eaten dipped in hot chocolate. So they brought us obviously vegan hot chocolate, and we were very happy campers. They were so friendly, and it was a lovely restaurant. It was a wonderful last dinner in York, a city I really look forward to returning to again and again. It was really, really fantastic. The next day, it was time to leave York and head up to the lakes, but on our itinerary was a stop in Haworth, which is a village in West Yorkshire where the Bronte family famously lived and wrote. So before we left York, we went to Goji again, as I mentioned, and we grabbed some food to go. We should have grabbed more, but we got some samosas and some roasted vegetable wraps and a delicious scone. I can't believe I only got one scone between the two of us. The scone was fantastic. It was like a blackberry scone. We should have gotten two. So they have wonderful food for takeaway, and which is great for just, you know, hitting the wonderful little areas around York. So we did that, and then we went on our way. Now, I must admit, you know, I've accurately titled this episode because I'm definitely a literary geek, as is David, and it was a bit of a dream come true to visit Haworth. I had read Jane Eyre, like most of us have, Charlotte Bronte's first successful novel when I was young, Wuthering Heights, which is Emily Bronte's only novel. She died just after its publication, sadly. And recently, I actually read Anne Bronte's The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. And at university, I studied Victorian literature with a Bronte fanatic, during which time I read more of Charlotte's work, Shirley and Villette. And my professor for this class was a Bronte nut, and she was a little eccentric herself. And I recall her sharing a slideshow of photos from her many trips to Haworth. And I just thought it would be a dream to walk on the moors where the Brontes walked and derived inspiration for their stories and their characters, the landscape itself being a major character in their books. So I must say I was pretty thrilled and very inspired to visit their home and stand in the rooms where they wrote their books and walk on the moorland just beyond their house. It's a beautiful place, Haworth, if not a little remote and a little gloomy. There was a little bit of gloominess to it, but in a romantic kind of way. So it was just a dream to be there, and I do recommend, if you are a literary geek like I am, to go visit the Brontes' house. It's worth it, really worth it. By late afternoon, we needed to begin our drive up to the lakes. It was getting dark, and luckily we had a little more food with us, some hummus wraps, along with some nuts and bread, but not much. We were pretty hungry and utterly exhausted by the time we arrived at our place in the Lake District. The drive, though, up to Ullswater Lake was incredibly beautiful. We drove along the edge of the Yorkshire Dales, and the scenery was just stunning all the way up. It was dark and chilly and a little drizzly by the time we arrived, but that just added to the beauty and the charm of the place we were staying. I'll put a picture up of the and a link up to the place we stayed at. It was incredible. It's called the Boathouse at Knott's End, and it was utterly breathtaking. In fact, as soon as we arrived, I knew we weren't staying there long enough. We were booked for two nights, by which time, you know, one night was already, we were about to go to sleep, so that was that. And then we were to drive up to Edinburgh and stay for five nights, but I really needed to stay in this place of refuge longer, and David felt the same way. So we'll definitely be back, and we'll stay much longer than two nights, and I recommend you do the same. Ullswater Lake is incredibly pristine, and the mountains around it are just breathtaking. The Boathouse at Knott's End is a small little beautiful stone structure that sits right on the lake, and our view was just the lake itself and the mountains surrounding it. It was absolutely stunning. The next morning, I just watched the fog roll across the mountains, and the low, fluffy clouds give way to blue sky. It was just gorgeous, and it was a perfect day the next day to journey to our next dream location, Grasmere, where William Wordsworth wrote and lived for many, many years, and where he received many regular guests, sometimes semi-permanent guests, and friends and fellow writers and collaborators, such as Coleridge, of course, the folks who were known as the Lake Poets, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Robert Southey, and Thomas de Quincey. Wordsworth called Grasmere the loveliest spot that man hath ever found, and I just can't argue with him. It was just so wonderful to be there. The drive to Grasmere from Ullswater was incredible. We drove down something that just made it sound like you really are taking your chances going down this road. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was just a beautiful drive down through the mountains, a dramatic landscape if there ever was one. In fact, one of the mountains we saw but didn't climb was Helvellyn. Now, I've talked about this mountain. I talked about it in my Animals in the Arts presentation, but I don't think I've talked about it here in this podcast. It's a mountain that many climbers climb, and it has a link to our topic of animals and compassion. And in April 1805, an artist named Charles Goff decided to climb Mount Helvellyn to head over to Grasmere along with his dog, Foxy. He was never heard from again after he set out. 3 months later, in July of the same year, in 1805, a shepherd heard a dog barking and went to investigate. And there he discovered Goff's remains, guarded by his faithful dog. Now, it became clear at that point that Goff had suffered a great fall, and he died from his injuries, most likely. But not only had Foxy survived during these 3 months, she also gave birth to a puppy who sadly did not survive. Well, when the story about this dog guarding her person's remains hit the papers, it had a powerful effect throughout Great Britain. And at least two artists painted depictions of this scene, one by Francis Danby and a famous one, a lovely painting called Attachment by Edwin Landseer. Now, Landseer contributed a number of works of art related to animals. I'll save that for another time. I really need to get my visual presentation up online sometime. I need to do that. But it wouldn't make sense to do an audio podcast of this presentation. It's very visual, but I'll get that painting up, or I'll put a link to it on this episode's page on my website. Anyway, aside from painters who used the story as a source of inspiration, poems were written by the likes of Sir Walter Scott and William Wordsworth. Now, Wordsworth used to climb Helvellyn regularly, and he brought his friend Walter Scott to the spot where Gough's body was found. Both were inspired to write a poem about the incident. Wordsworth's poem is called Fidelity, and Scott's poem is called Helvellyn. I thought I'd read Fidelity to you, and I encourage you to read Scott's as well. And just so you know, in the poem, there's a word that you might not be familiar with. Tarn, T-A-R-N, is a small lake in the mountains. It's a small mountain lake. So here is William Wordsworth's Fidelity. A barking sound the shepherd hears, a cry as of a dog or fox. He halts and searches with his eyes among the scattered rocks. And now at distance can discern a stirring in a brake of fern, from which immediately leaps out a dog, and yelping runs about. The dog is not of mountain breed, its motions too are wild and shy, with something, as the shepherd thinks, unusual in its cry. Nor is there anyone in sight all round, in hollow or on height, nor shout nor whistle strikes his ear. What is the creature doing here? It was a cove, a huge recess that keeps till June, December's snow, a lofty precipice in front, a silent tarn below. Far in the bosom of Helvellyn, remote from public road or dwelling, pathway or cultivated land, from trace of human foot or hand. There sometimes does a leaping fish send through the tarn a lonely cheer. The crags repeat the raven's croak in symphony austere. Thither the rainbow comes, the cloud and mist that spread the flying shroud, and sunbeams and the sounding blast that if it could would hurry past, but that enormous barrier binds it fast. Not knowing what to think, a while the shepherd stood, then makes his way towards the dog or rocks and stones as quickly as he may. Nor far had gone before he found a human skeleton on the ground. Sad sight, the shepherd with a sigh looks round to learn the history. From those abrupt and perilous rocks, the man had fallen that place of fear. At length upon the shepherd's mind it breaks, and all is clear. He instantly recalled the name, and who he was, and whence he came. Remembered, too, the very day on which the traveller passed this way. But hear a wonder now, forsake, of which this mournful tale I tell. A lasting monument of words this wonder merits well. The dog, which still was hovering nigh, repeating the same timid cry, this dog had been through 3 months' space a dweller in that savage place. Yes, proof was plain that since the day on which the traveller thus had died, the dog had watched about the spot or by his master's side. How nourished here through such long time, he knows, who gave that love sublime, and gave that strength of feeling great above all human estimate. So it was so lovely that so many people were moved by this story. I mean, it was a story that just, it hit the national papers, and people all around were moved. And as I've said before, certainly art and poetry and the visual arts are the most lasting monument to anyone and to any story. And so it's quite beautiful that we have these works to reflect the beauty of this story. In some ways, it's not a surprise. We know that animals love us as much as we love them, especially our beloved domesticated animals, and dogs in particular. They're known for the loyalty to their humans, but it's still a pretty striking, moving story. So anyway, we arrived in Grasmere just in time for lunch, and we walked around this gorgeous mountain lake town a bit, understanding immediately why William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy decided to live here upon arriving and seeing the cottage that was to be their home for 8.5 years. Now, we ate lunch at this adorable little restaurant called Potted Out, and we dined on a fabulous meal of vegetable pizza. Honestly, this pizza was one of my favorite pizzas ever. It was a great pizza. It was a perfect crust, a perfect thin crust, delicious sauce, and we had a fantastic bruschetta with tomato and garlic, but also with an olive tapenade. It was just delicious. The rest of our day was a dream. First, we visited the aforementioned cottage that William and Dorothy, Dorothy was William's sister, his confidant, his housemate, and his writing assistant for most of his life. They rented this cottage for over 8 years, during which time William wrote what would become some of his most famous poems that still endure today. Wordsworth has always been a favorite poet of mine, mainly because of how much nature played a role in his life and work. Like Wordsworth, my study is the outdoors. I simply cannot spend enough time outside. And it's one of the reasons I'm so grateful to be in this new house. It's quite a retreat surrounded by nature, but still close enough to the city. And I even named our house as Wordsworth named his house. Ours is Little Montali, named after Country House Montali in Umbria in Italy, because it really is our little Italian retreat here. And the Wordsworths named their cottage Dove Cottage. And it was incredibly special to walk where the Wordsworths walked. And we hiked from Grasmere to Rydal, which is a beautiful 2-mile walk in the woods. It's a wonderful hike, during which time David and I composed a short little 4-line poem together, inspired by the poems Wordsworth would write as he walked on the same ground. So it's pretty cool. Yes, we're total geeks. I am not denying it. I've already admitted it. So that was how Wordsworth worked. He would spend outside all day, and he would walk in nature, and he would find inspiration from it and in it. And he would write poetry in his mind, and then he would return home, and his sister Dorothy, and subsequently his wife Mary, would literally be his hands. They would transcribe and also discuss with William the poems. So next would come the editing, and this was what William would really work on with his own hands. And this is not dissimilar from how I work, though I write down my thoughts myself. I don't have anyone writing my thoughts down for me, but Wordsworth really found it laborious, physically laborious to write, and rightfully so, considering how much and how often he wrote. And his sister and his wife played huge roles in his writing life. And I too dislike the physical act of writing with a pen. My brain works faster than my hands can write. And it's why I'm on the computer so much, because I can type so quickly. But it's also hard because there are physical consequences to typing too much. So that's the cross I bear. And it's certainly what Wordsworth experienced as well. Oh, the pain I endure. Michko, my little kitty, just brought up her toy, her little, oh my goodness, for me to play with. It's too much. So we hiked from Grasmere to Rydal, and we got to Rydal late in the afternoon as the sun was setting, giving us just enough time to visit the house at called Rydal Mount, where the Wordsworths, William and his sister and his wife, and by now a number of children in tow, lived the rest of their lives. And the house is still in the hands of Wordsworth's heirs. It's not actually a museum. It's privately owned, but the family opens it to the public for several months of the year. And it's such a gift to be there. The gardens were designed and planted by the Wordsworths, and they're absolutely stunning. So it's absolutely worth going if you are so inclined. So the hike back to Grasmere was equally lovely, and we retrieved our car and ventured to Ambleside. Ambleside is just on the other side of Rydal, so it was really close by. We got some groceries, including some fair trade vegan wine, and then we headed to Fellini's, a lovely vegetarian restaurant we had made reservations for the night before. So they had several vegan items, though you wouldn't necessarily know what to look at the menu, as none of the main dishes were marked with a V next to them. The V indicated that they were vegan or veganizable. So none of the main dishes had a V. There were 5 main dishes. And so when I asked if they had any main dishes that could be made vegan, our server replied that indeed 3 of the 5 dishes could be made vegan. So at the end of our meal, I suggested they might want to update their menu to indicate this. And they said, well, it's hard because our V right now means what was already vegan. And I suggested that they simply expand it to mean already vegan or veganizable. Not that hard. you know, brilliant a suggestion, but they liked it. And I do plan to follow up with them. So if you ever go there, if you even look at their menu online, just because it doesn't have a V next to the dish, doesn't mean it can't be made vegan. Okay. So we enjoyed a delicious seasonal salad. I had the fennel risotto. The fennel risotto was really good. It was fantastic. David had the stuffed peppers. The vegan desserts had a lot to be desired, but in support of the one they had on the menu, we ordered it. It was an apple thyme crumble with strawberry sorbet. It was good, but it would be nice to see them do some more vegan desserts. I find this at a lot of vegetarian places. They really tend to cater to vegetarians or non-vegetarians, and I don't see a lot of vegan desserts on the menus. But I still recommend it. It's a lovely area. Go to Grasmere, go to Rydal, spend the day there. Go to Fellini's. They even have a theater affiliated with them, a fantastic theater that's called Zeffirelli's. So it was kind of it was kind of awesome because we love film and we love veganism and we love literature. And so it was a kind of a perfect storm, all of these places all in one area. So Fellini'sAmbleside.com. I'll also have this link on my website. We watched a movie when we got back to the boathouse, and it was just a really nice night. If you are interested, this movie was called The Sporting Life, which I don't know if you like kitchen sink dramas. Kitchen sink dramas is kind of this genre of British films that were made in the 50s and 60s, and they're kind of gritty, very sad, very depressing about kind of home life and kind of in industrial areas. And this one's called The Sporting Life with Richard Harris, whose performance was unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. Clearly influenced by a young Marlon Brando, but it was just a fantastic film. I highly recommend. So we did that. And sadly, when we woke up the next day, it was time to leave the lakes. It was just so sad. I really wish we had stayed there longer. It was pouring when we woke up, so we didn't get to take the rowboat out on the lake, but you have your own little rowboat when you stay at the boathouse at Knott's End. So we headed north to see Hadrian's Wall, and we braved the rain for that, as well as for the remains of a Roman fort. And we continued driving north to Scotland, by which time it stopped raining, which was lovely. We arrived at our hotel exhausted and starving, and so we ventured out to Henderson's Bistro for dinner. Now, Henderson's is a mainstay in Edinburgh. Anybody who searches for anything vegetarian in Edinburgh will not have a hard time finding Henderson's. It first opened in 1962, and now they have, I think, four locations, if not more. And each one is different from the next. We went to the bistro the first night, which is a little nicer than the restaurant, in that the bistro is more of a sit-down service affair, whereas the restaurant, which is bigger with more selections, is such that you order at the counter and then you take your tray to your table. It's more casual, but I liked the restaurant very much. I didn't love the service at the bistro that first night. It was just probably just an off night for this lovely woman, but we did go there twice because we wanted to have that sit-down experience. In fact, the first night we went, we didn't realize the main restaurant was just around the corner, literally. And they have music every night at the bigger space, the restaurant, the more casual place. So that first night at the bistro, David had the vegan haggis made with beans and oats and a gorgeous red wine sauce. Now, we've never had haggis from a sheep's stomach, so we don't know what it tastes like and can't compare it to that, but it was delicious. In fact, when we went back to the bistro that last night in Edinburgh, we both ordered the vegan haggis again because it was so good. And now David has tasked me to make this at home. So I will be attempting my own vegan haggis at home. The next day for breakfast, we enjoyed a number of the things our hotel had laid out for us. Again, cereal. They made sure we had soy milk, they had fruit and juices and teas, and they even made my pancake recipe, which was pretty sweet. I had been in touch with them prior to our booking the place, and they said that they would make sure that we had some hot breakfast options, so I offered a few of my recipes. And so they used the pancake recipe every day, so, you know, we had plenty of food without the pancakes, but we felt compelled to order them every day because they were going through the trouble of accommodating us, which was very sweet. So it wasn't they did a lovely job. It just would be nice to see. I would love to be able to consult with restaurants and bed and breakfast and schools and cafeterias more to really help them just get outside of their just meat and animal product oriented menus. There's just so many more creative things they could do. And clearly pancakes is not what they would normally have. They didn't have non-vegan pancakes. They had, you know, eggs and scrambles and all different things. And I would just love to help them just get outside of their kind of status quo way of thinking. So anyway, it was very lovely and I appreciated the effort they made. Unfortunately, the next day, from the moment we woke up to the moment our heads hit the pillow, it poured all day long. And it was our only rainy day, really, in the 6 days we were in Scotland. So I'm not complaining, but it did make it hard to enjoy the city that first day and get it into my blood. Perhaps crazily, we headed to Edinburgh Castle that first day. We were not the only ones. We were all completely drenched, but we made the most of it. And the view, of course, is incredible from Edinburgh Castle. And you do a lot of walking around on the outside. That's why we were drenched. There's a military museum. There's a war museum. There's a museum that houses the crown jewels. Most sweetly, I thought, there's a dog cemetery. It's been used since the time of Queen Victoria to bury regimental mascots and officers' dogs. So for all the animals they eat, as I have to say, the people of Great Britain love their dogs. In fact, once we left the castle and ventured to lunch, this became evident to us even more. There's a wonderful story that's become legend in Edinburgh about a dog named Greyfriars Bobby, Bobby for short, who, legend has it, spent 14 years guarding the grave of his person until he died himself on January 14th, 1872. A year after he died, a statue was erected in his honor, and there have been several books written and films made about this little dog. In 1867, when some people wanted to have this stray dog destroyed because he was a stray, the Lord Provost of Edinburgh, Sir William Chambers, who was also a director of the Scottish Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, paid for Bobby's license, making him the responsibility of the city council. And that had never been done before. I don't think it's ever been done since. And recently, there have been attempts to disprove that the dog hung around his person's grave for 14 years, that there was more than one dog, that strays all hung around in the cemetery. However, the story is so ingrained in the city's romantic consciousness that it just doesn't matter, I think, at this point, whether it's true or not. It's just a lovely story. And again, it's a testament to us wanting to celebrate this relationship and the connection that humans and non-humans have. And not only that, the connection we have for them, because we know how much we love our dogs, right, and our cats and our kind of the animals with whom we live, but we're struck by and maybe surprised by the commitment we see the animals having to us. And I just wish that we realized this was just more common than not. So it's a wonderful story and it endures in the city. And indeed, in front of the Greyfriars Bobby pub, there is the statue of this dog. The pub itself is really lovely. We took shelter from the rain in there for a few hours, and it's worth going. I really liked this pub a lot. Right nearby is a fabulous Italian restaurant we loved so much that we went back a second time. Thank God for the Italians. I mean, wherever we go, we can always count on finding an Italian restaurant where we can easily find delicious food, because Italian food is just really so much about just real ingredients and real food. We intended to eat at Divino. It's a pretty little Italian bistro on a hidden little street called Merchant Street. So definitely go down there. It's underneath the pub. It's underneath the Greyfriars Bobby pub. Unfortunately, Divino was closed that week for renovations. So we went to the Italian restaurant just upstairs from them, which turns out is affiliated with them, called Vittoria. The food was fantastic. The first time we went there, we got the pasta and pizza between us. They do where you can get like half pizza and half pasta, or you can get a whole, but we wanted to split. So we got half pizza, half pasta. Just fantastic. Their focaccia was amazing. We went back again for the risotto and the caponata, and they even had a separate vegetarian menu. Now, I tend to like looking at the full menu, even when they have a separate vegetarian menu, because I like to see everything that's possible, everything that can be potentially made vegan that they may not have thought of. I mean, look at what happened with Fellini's restaurant. It's a vegetarian restaurant. They didn't even mark on their menu what things could be veganized. So I like to look at the main menu, but I love the fact that they have their own vegetarian menu. They're very conscious of vegetarians, obviously. So you can check them out at vittoriagroup.co.uk. That's vittoriagroup.co.uk. And I'll put them up on the website as well. And you can see the vegetarian menu on their website. So go there. The service is impeccable and the food is authentic Italian. And actually, so are the servers. And it was fun to practice my Italian when I was there. I wish I saw more vegetarian restaurants have the kind of service that I see at many non-vegetarian restaurants. I wish vegan restaurants really took the cue that in order to be taken seriously by the general public, they need to really up their game. And unfortunately, I have just seen too many vegetarian restaurants. I don't know what it is. Just get lazy, just take for granted that they think vegans will come and vegetarians will come no matter what, that they don't have to have impeccable service. But I'll tell you, it makes a huge difference. And I really wish I saw that more. And so this Italian restaurant, the service was just so stunning. And service is a big part of the experience for me. So Vittoria restaurant in Edinburgh. So after enjoying some shelter from the rain for a few hours, we ventured back out and walked on the Royal Mile some more and then back out. I'm not giving you all these details. So we didn't just walk a few, you know, minutes and then eat again, but we did wind up back at a restaurant. I'm sparing you all the details of our trip at a wonderful vegetarian restaurant in Old Town called David Bann's, and B-A-N-N apostrophe S, or I guess it's called David Bann. And it's been there for 20 years or something. It's been there for a long time. Another vegetarian restaurant with a number of vegan options. We enjoyed Thai veggie cakes as a starter. I had the smoked tofu with ginger rice and veggies for my entree. David had some kind of phyllo dish with beans and veggies cooked in some Mexican spices. It was very good. We did not opt for dessert. There, I think maybe was one vegan dessert, but we weren't interested anyway. But they are conscious of vegans. They should be. They're a vegetarian restaurant, and it's worth going. I really enjoyed this. Nice, really, again, nice location and a nice ambiance. Service could have been better also, but nothing horrible. Just I think I have high standards when it comes to service. In retrospect, as I said, we probably should have stayed in Edinburgh one less night to just go up to the Highlands and the surrounding areas, but we did the best we could on Thursday when we drove up to the Trossachs National Park. Being there in October, being in the UK in October, of course, was risky. We tend to do our big trip in the fall because I just love the fall, but of course, there's the potential for rain. However, it was just perfect because of the fall color on the trees. We saw some of the most beautiful fall color in Grasmere, in the lakes, and even some down in York, but it was magnificent up in the Trossachs. First along Lake Vanacar, V-E-N-A-C-H-A-R, Vanacar, and then later in the afternoon in Luss, which was just an adorable town. So we stopped in Callander first. Nothing really special in this town, and we weren't ready to eat yet, so we ventured on, enjoyed some more exquisite scenery, and then we stopped in a tiny little town called Ableford, where we figured we would just have some chips. I mean, there were pretty much just pubs in this place, and we were just hungry, and we were fine if we just had some chips and some pizza. So there were a few fish and chip places, there was a butcher, and there was a pub or two, and I had my eye on this pub called the Fourth Inn, F-O-R-T-H. The Fourth Inn upon arriving. So we went over there, we looked at the menu, it looked awful, but I just had a good feeling about it, frankly, compared to everything else, it looked like the best. And so we went in, we sat down in the little dining room and we saw that they had chips, of course, and a green salad, and we saw that they had risotto. So I asked the manager, our server was the manager, owner of the place, and I said, oh, is the risotto made with vegetable stock and not chicken stock, you know, et cetera. And he confirmed that it was. And I said, oh, that's great. Could you make it without cheese? And he said, no problem. I said, oh, fantastic. So, you know, we got the risotto. It had, you know, peppers and tomatoes, et cetera. And we got some chips between the two of us and fries between the two of us. So when the risotto arrived, it was swimming in cream sauce. And I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I should have clarified, but is this cream? And he said, yes, it was. And I said, I'm so sorry. We'll pay for it, but we're not going to eat it. We were looking for no cream because when I think of risotto, that's just not what I think of. I don't think of cream. And of course, I didn't take my own advice, which is usually in a restaurant. I talk about this in the 30-day vegan challenge in the video for eating out. I talk about saying, you know, say the word vegan, but explain what vegan is. So normally when I order something in a non-vegan restaurant, I'll say, hi, we're vegan. Can you tell me if I order anything that has any cream or any dairy or any cheese or eggs? And so it just kind of says vegan, so it gets it out there, but it also clarifies what it is because some people think vegan means eating chickens. So I didn't do that. I just asked about the stock and I asked about the extra cheese they would put on it and I didn't clarify. So I said, I'm so sorry. I just, you know, I should have clarified. It's my fault. And he said, no worries. Let me see what we can do. So he went to the chef. He came back and he said, the chef's going to take care of it. And he returned with new risotto without the cream sauce and just the veggies. And so we were enjoying our food and about halfway through he came back and he said, so are you guys vegans? Are you both vegan? And we said yes. And I was a little surprised because I didn't expect this manager of this small little pub in this small little town to know the word vegan, which was so wrong. I love being wrong. I love being wrong. I should not have presumed that. I don't know if that's why I didn't say vegan, but I think that was probably in the back of my mind. And he said, oh, you should have told me. If you come back, let me know and my chef will make something special for you. And he went on to say that his chef came from some fancy smanchy restaurant and he was very skilled and he would have been able to make something lovely for us. So there you have it. I did not take my own advice and I encourage you to take my advice and never underestimate the person you're talking to. It was just beautiful and we had a lovely, lovely chat with him. Then it was off to Luss, which is a gorgeous, picturesque town on Lake Lomond. We walked around the river. We walked around this little church where I think some of the graves date back to the 7th century. And we just enjoyed the sunset on this gorgeous evening. So Luss, L-U-S-S, by the way. And finally, it was time to head to Glasgow to see Alan Davies. For those who don't know, he's a British comic and he's one of my favorites. And he was at the Pavilion Theatre in Glasgow. And he's revealed a couple of times in different mediums that he's vegetarian. When we met him and we had a picture taken with him, I'll put that on the page as well because I was pretty excited to meet him. The poor guy looked so exhausted and I didn't have the heart to engage him in that conversation. But he remembered my tweet. I said that we had revolved our trip around Alan's performance, which is kind of true because we knew we were going in October. But when I found out that Alan was doing a show in Glasgow on that date, we kind of revolved our trip around him being there. So when I told him that and I had tweeted it already, he said, yeah, I remember your tweet. Did you tweet about that? And so we talked a bit and it was really lovely. And since then, I've asked him on Twitter if he's still vegetarian and I'm still waiting for his response. So I'll keep you posted. Friday was a cloudy but dry day, and we got to walk around a lot. First, this is back in Edinburgh. We went to the Georgian House, which was built in 1791, and it's now decorated to reflect 18th century living, and it was really lovely. I do recommend it. And then we continued to walk around Newtown, and we stopped by various houses, including the one Walter Scott was born in, and the one Kenneth Graham was born in. Kenneth Graham, of course, being the author of The Wind in the Willows, and the house that Percy Shelley and his Harriet honeymooned in after they had eloped to Edinburgh. And we must remember Shelley, of course, for all his brilliance, as well as for what he wrote about vegetarianism and several of his writings, including in A Vindication of Natural Diet and in Queen Mab, and I Wish No Living Thing to Suffer Pain, he wrote in Prometheus Unbound. So love Shelley, and it was fun to see where he and his wife had honeymooned. Next, we walked up to the top of the Scott Monument. If you've never seen the Scott Monument, you can see it by just going online and searching for it. It's kind of crazy, ridiculous, and huge. And the best way I could describe it is that it looks like the top of a Gothic rocket ship. It's wild, and I'm not sure how I feel about the design, but it was pretty amazing to see such a monument erected to a writer. And the view from the top is magnificent. It's 280 steps to the top, so it was just worth going up there. It was pretty fabulous. We walked around Rose Street a bit, and then we enjoyed a drink at Milne's Pub, where a number of Scottish writers used to hang out, and I think contemporary writers still do. So continuing our literary geek theme, next we met a group at the Beehive in Grassmarket, which is a lovely part of Old Town, to go on our literary pub tour. We had a wonderful time visiting the haunts of various Scottish and English writers, and our tour guides were lovely. They were actors. In fact, one of them was really sweet. He had actually been to Oakland in our neck of the woods, where we live, several years before. And so he was so sweet. We had a lovely talk with him. He asked me what I do, and I told him, and he very much appreciated the work that I do. And he has since friended me on Facebook. And he said his wife was vegetarian and that he appreciated someone speaking up for the animals. And we've since communicated via Facebook and you never know, planting seeds and all of that. So Saturday was our last day. And it was a lovely day. We enjoyed some sunny weather and we started the day visiting a number of bookstores. It was really funny. At one bookstore where we spent most of our time and most of our money, a woman was there with lots of baked goods as a fundraiser for a book fair that she was helping to organize. And finally, because she had asked us if we wanted any baked goods, and we said, no, thank you. And finally, she said, when we were paying, she said, are you sure you don't want anything? And I turned around and looked at the spread before her, and there were homemade cupcakes and little tarts and everything. And I said, thanks so much. I said, we're vegan. That's the only reason we're not buying anything. And she pointed to these cupcakes and she said, these are vegan. And so she had one whole plate of vegan cupcakes. So there were vegan treats. So again, just don't underestimate. You just don't know. It was so lovely. And of course, we bought a few and we went on our merry way and they were delicious. So sparing you the details of the rest of our city walk and cathedral visits, we ate at David Ben again for lunch, had their hummus plate, which was very good, and one of their salads and their soup of the day. It was a lovely restaurant, and I recommend them, davidban.com, davidban.com. I might say, though, that one of the highlights of our visit was the Writers' Museum. It's a tiny museum tucked behind the Jolly Judge pub on the Royal Mile, which is quite a gem. The museum is a gem. The Jolly Judge is a little bit of a gem as well. We went in there during our tour, but the Writers' Museum was really a gem. It focuses on Edinburgh's literary Illuminati, Robert Burns, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Walter Scott. I think it's safe to say that Robert Burns is Scotland's national poet. You'll know him, of course, as the author of the lyrics to Auld Lang Syne, but many, 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 many more things as well. And if you have the Vegan's Daily Companion, you'll remember a couple poems of his that I included, particularly a poem called On Seeing a Wounded Hare Limp By Me, which a fellow had just shot at, and another one called To a Mouse on Turning Her Up in Her Nest with the Plow. So check those out. It's he speaks for the animals. It's quite lovely. Regarding Robert Louis Stevenson, I have a soft spot in my heart for him. He was the author of Kidnapped and Treasure Island and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And apparently our actor guides assured us that it's pronounced Jekyll, not Jekyll. So I will from henceforth be saying Jekyll, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And anyway, I have a soft spot in my heart for him because he was sickly all his life. He was a fantastic writer and he died too young at 44, very sadly. And at this museum, I found this little gem of a quote next to a fishing rod and a basket that belonged to him. And I wanted to share this with you. Just happened upon this. It was so lovely. He wrote, this was in a letter he wrote to J.M. Barrie, who was another Scottish writer. And yes, of course, he was the one who created Peter Pan. So this was a letter to J.M. Barrie in 1894. And this is what Robert Louis Stevenson wrote. He wrote, I had always been accustomed to pause and very laboriously kill every fish as I took it. But in the Queen's River in 1871, I took so good a basket that I forgot these niceties, and when I sat down in a hard rain shower under a bank to take my sandwiches and sherry, lo and behold, there was a basketful of trouts still kicking in their agony. I had a very unpleasant conversation with my conscience. All that afternoon, I persevered in fishing, brought home my basket in triumph, and sometime that night, I finally forswore the gentle art of fishing. I don't know. I just thought that was really cool because this is what I'm talking about. It's not about factory farming. It's not about the methods. It's about the violent act of killing animals who would choose to live. So I was thrilled to stumble upon that quote from Stevenson. And the museum was really quite a gem. I highly recommend it if you visit this wonderful city. Upon leaving the museum, we headed to Henderson's Takeaway to pick up some food for our very long flight home, which turned out to be a 24-hour long endeavor. It was horrible. But luckily we had vegan pasties and sandwiches and wraps, and we dined on Henderson's vegan haggis once more. And we headed to a talk with David Mitchell, one of my favorite British comics. I was really stoked to meet two of my favorite comic heroes, Alan Davies and David Mitchell. So we happened upon this. We didn't know David Mitchell was in town. He lives in London. And we went to this conversation with him because he just wrote a new book called Backstory. And so what was really funny was just before David and his interviewer came onto the stage, I tweeted and I posted on Facebook that we were attending a conversation with David Mitchell and that though I tried to make a vegan connection, I had nothing. So that's what I had tweeted. I said, I got nothing. There's no vegan connection. I'm excited to see David Mitchell. And I've heard him say derogatory things about vegetarians in the past on different panel shows, but it's kind of his persona. I mean, he's a comic and he's kind of known as this curmudgeonly opinionated snob. So I didn't take it to heed, whatever. Maybe he meant it or not, but I don't stop listening to a comic that I like just because he says something derogatory. However, I didn't think there was any vegan connection. And what's wonderful about David Mitchell is not just how funny he is, but how intelligent and self-aware and brilliant he is. But of course, experiencing the same blocks we all do as they relate to our relationship to animals and our denial of our deep compassion. So with this in mind, and with the tweet just having gone out to the world, it was incredibly poignant that the interviewer asked David Mitchell, pretty much up front in the interview to read an excerpt from his book, which I'm sure was received as great humor by the crowd, but not without some sympathy and guilt as well. He read an excerpt from his book about a traumatic moment in his childhood when his very English parents were vacationing in France and wanted their son to experience French cuisine. So they bought a lobster, of course, a live lobster. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it just started off like this. The other food which I was encouraged to try was lobster. At one point in the holiday, as a special treat to make up for the fact that they couldn't afford to eat in any of the nice French restaurants, my parents decided to buy and cook a lobster that was alive. I know that's the only way fresh lobsters come, but it seemed to me a perverse way to buy food. I was aware that much of what I had ate once roamed free and careless, but my instinctive response, and one that I stick to, was not to think about it, to avoid contemplating the fact that my dinner may once have been a lovable, cuddly, helpless thing. Now, that pretty much sums up the mentality of most of us who do, or once did, eat animals. I don't want to think about it. And putting our heads in the sand is exactly why millions of animals have their heads cut from their bodies. I don't want to think about it. So I appreciated his honesty. And he went on to tell a really horrific story about boiling the lobster alive, concluding the story and the chapter by saying that he didn't have any of it that night. But he also went on to say that he's never been and probably never will be vegetarian. But he was appalled by this whole experience. And I just thought it was just so funny and amazing that here I had just said in my tweet that I was attending the show that had no vegan connection, and here he was reading an excerpt from his book that revealed the disconnect and the trauma we all experience when we consume animals. Then again, it's not that funny or incredible at all, because our affection for living animals and our desire to not want to hurt them is universal. No matter where you are, no matter where you go, no matter how you grew up, no matter what time you grew up in. And my hope is that this awareness will continue to propel us toward a shared universal commitment where we honor both our predilection toward compassion and our aversion toward causing harm. When this guides our thoughts and our actions, what an amazing world this will be. For the animals, both human and non-human, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.